Okay, the story of Esther. There is a lot in this story for us to try to consider, and obviously we're not going to get to all of it. Who are the main characters? Who are the main characters in the story of Esther? Babo.
Esther.
We got one. Mordecai. Haman. And the king. Those are your four major characters. How are Esther and Mordecai related?
Cousins.
Okay. Whose name is found the most in the book of Esther? You would think it's Esther, right? Mordecai's name is found more than Esther in the book, which I think is interesting. That when you're reading through this book, you find Mordecai mentioned more than you find Esther mentioned. But the person you find mentioned the most is the king. Esther is found by name about 55, 56 times. Mordecai is found by name about 60 times. Haman is found by name about 54 times. But the king is found, referred to almost 200 times, more than 200 times. He's kind of a central character that everybody revolves around throughout it. But what I want us to do tonight is, I think, right at the heart of the story of Esther, and obviously we're going to be looking at selflessness because that's the theme of this particular study, but right at the heart of this story is a contrast between self-centeredness and selflessness. And Esther's selflessness is seen in vivid detail because of the self-centeredness of Haman. And so what I want us to do is, I want us to spend a little time talking about Haman, and then I want us to spend a little bit of time talking about Esther. And then at the end tonight, we're going to talk about how Haman's self-centeredness is equally opposed, is equally contrasted over in Esther's selflessness. We'll see if we can try to do that. So who is Haman? Who's Haman? Okay. One of the members of the king's court. Look in chapter 3. You read about Haman first in chapter 3 and verse 1. And it appears that perhaps Haman had as high a rank as maybe even second in command to the king. After these kings, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. He promoted him and then advanced him, and he set his seat above all the princes who were with him. It's a very high official in the king's court. Perhaps even his second in charge, because he just appears so frequently when we're reading about the king and reading about Haman. You saw it in the masterfully done skit. What was Haman's evil plot? He wanted to kill all the Jews. Look in chapter 3 and verse 6. Where it says that he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for he had told him of the people of Mordecai. And we'll come back and talk about that in a minute. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all of the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. He wanted to kill every single one of them. So he goes to the king in verse 7. First month, the month of Nisan, the 12th year of King Ahasuerus' reign. Comes to him in verse 8, and he says, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all of the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay for it." How badly did Haman want the Jews dead? He was willing to come to the king and not even identify the people, to mischaracterize them to a point, and then, in case the king was going to say, well, let me check the budget, you know, because I'm not sure if we have enough budget, enough money in the budget to wipe out an entire race. In order to take that out of the king's arsenal, he just said, you know what? And I will pay for it. That's how much he wanted these people dead. And so the king in verse 12, gives unto Haman his signet ring. What did that signify? He gave his approval to Haman. When he gives him the ring, does he more or less give him a blank check? Here's my ring. Go and put my seal on whatever you write. That'd be kind of dangerous, wouldn't it? Would you do that with your kids? Give them a blank check? Are there many people that you would say, you know what, here is my authority. Go and use it. He gave him his signet ring. Put it into his hand in order that he might go and take care of the enemy. He says in verse 11, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. You don't even have to pay for it. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. So he goes and he sits down and he writes. He has the scribes write down this official proclamation that's going to go throughout the entire land. Verse 13 says that this decree is sent out. Look in verse 13. The letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to do what? To destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the Jews. What's the difference? If you destroy them, aren't you killing them? If you kill them, aren't you annihilating? What's the difference? Wipe them off the face of the earth. No remains. And in case you don't understand destroy, then I'll say kill. If you don't understand kill, I'll say annihilate. I want them gone. I want everybody, young and old, men and women, in one day, I want them wiped out. And I want you to plunder their possessions. Copy of the document, verse 14, was to be issued as law. This was not an option. This was not a suggestion. This was not a wish that was being sent out. This was a law that was to be followed. And the time period indicates that this was to take place. Basically, on their calendar, it was January. And this was to take place in the 12th month, which would be correspond, obviously, to our December. So you've got 11 months that transpire there. Look in chapter 4. This message goes out. Chapter 4, verse 1, Mordecai learned all that had happened. Verse 3 says, in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many of them lay in sackcloth and in ashes. Their race is about ready to be destroyed because of one man. We're going to come back and talk about his motivation in just a minute. But you think about Haman and his plot. His desire was to wipe out an entire race. Go to chapter 5. Look in chapter 5. Before we talk about why he wanted to wipe them out, I want us to see in chapter 5 and verse 11, what did he possess? I think this is an interesting contrast to look at in comparison to what he possessed and then how that made him feel. Look in chapter 5, verse 11. Haman told, he gathers his friends, he gathers his wife and his friends in verse 10. Verse 11, he says, he told them of his great riches. Is Haman lacking in financial wealth? He told them of his great riches. He told them of the multitude of his children. He told them everything in which the king had promoted him. The king keeps advancing me, how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Moreover, Haman was bragging. He said, you know what, besides that, Queen Esther, she has invited no one except for me. She didn't invite anybody else. She only, the king too. Yeah, the king's going to be there too. But she only invited me in with the king to a banquet. It is all me. Riches, kids, the promotions, and the status. Look at what he says in verse 13. He's got it all. And yet what? Yet all of this is nothing. What is his problem? What was the cause? What was the reason? Why did Haman, why did he want to kill an entire race? Because of one guy. One guy. Not because he didn't like all of the Jews. It was because one man stood up to him. And that was it. That was the only thing that caused this. Go back to chapter 3. In chapter 3, it was a command of the king. In verse 2, all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage. Not to the king. They would do that too. But Haman comes out and all of the servants, they bow and they pay homage to Haman. For the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai, he's not going to do that. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over in Babylon were told to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's golden image. Did they bow down? No, they didn't bow down. Here's a man, Haman. Mordecai says, I'm not going to bow down to you. Then the king's servants who were with him within the gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? You're going to get yourself in trouble. Something's going to go really wrong. Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. One guy. Everybody else is bowing down. But this one guy is not. Look in chapter 5. Chapter 5 and verse 9. It says, Haman went out that day, joyful and glad with heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, Haman was in a good mood until he saw Mordecai. When he saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand, and he did not tremble when Haman came by, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. You go back to chapter 5, Haman has everything. He's got everything that a noble could want. What's he lacking? He's got all the money. He's got all the power. He's got all the status. What else could you want? He let one man dictate his actions. He let one man take his attention off of everything good that was happening in his life and to steer him in a direction to kill an entire race of people. How do you get from wanting to do something to Mordecai to say, you know what, not just Mordecai, let's just wipe out everybody in the nation that's a Jew? How do you jump from point A to point B? How do you do that? This guy got something wrong? You look at his anger at this one man who is not bowing down to him. Look in chapter 5. Chapter 5, we just read verse 9 where it says that he was in a good mood. He had come out from the first banquet with the king and the queen. And, you know, he was the only one there. It was just him, the king, and the queen. He's in a good mood when he comes out of that first banquet. It's all about him. But then he sees Mordecai and he's filled with indignation, the end of verse 9. But verse 10 says he restrained himself. I mean, he's under control, right? He went home, sent and called his friends and his wife. And Haman told them of all that he had. We read that. We saw verse 12 where he said, you know what? I even got invited to the queen. And yet all of this, it means nothing. all of this is absolutely nothing to me. Because as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate, it does not matter what I have. So what did his family tell him to do? Verse 14. His wife, Zeresh, and all of his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high." How tall is that?
7.5 stories.
75 feet. 75 gallows. How tall do gallows have to be to work? You know, I mean, if you got a short guy, they don't have to be very tall. 75 feet. How are you going to get up 75 feet to hang the guy? I mean, yeah, that's impressive, but seriously? I mean, why 75 feet? Why don't you make gallows 75 feet, 50 cubits high, and in the morning go and suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it, and then go merrily with the king to the banquet? You know what? That'll just make your day. If you can go to the king and say, "Hey, let's hang Mordecai," and the king says, "Okay," then you go to the banquet and you'll be in a good mood. And what does it say at the end of verse 14? Yep. Haman said, "That's all right." That pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Here's Haman. In contrast to what we're going to see in the life of Esther, in a very selfless woman, here is Haman that is all wrapped up in himself. Self-centered to the point of being pathetic. Now, what do we know about Esther? Who was Esther? Mordecai's cousin. She's a Jew. She's an orphan. Her parents are dead. How did she become queen then? If she's an orphan, raised by her cousin, she's a Jew. How did she become queen? She was a virgin. She was selected. Why was she selected? Okay, Vashti's gone. We got to get a replacement for Vashti. King's got to have a queen. And she's pretty. Go back to chapter 2. Remember what we saw about Samson last night? That he's a pretty shallow guy. Same thing with this king, apparently. Look in chapter 2, verse 2. The king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king." Three qualifications. If you don't meet one of these three, you're not one. So they bring in, and Esther is put into this mix thanks to Mordecai. They bring them in for 12 months of beauty preparation. They don't even see the king for a year. They spend 12 months getting ready to be qualified, to be getting ready to be pretty enough to go see the king. "Let the king appoint," verse 3, "officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins." That's the only ones. "Bring them to Shushan," capital city, "into the women's quarters under the custody." Shushan was where the king kind of had his winter quarters. "Into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch. He will be the custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them." Well, what was that going to involve? Look over in verse 12. "Each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation, according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women." Seriously? I'm going to say something that's not going to make me very popular. Imagine that. Should I say this? "I know it takes some women a while to get ready in the morning." It doesn't take my wife very long. All right, so I'll qualify that. "I know it takes some women kind of long to get ready in the morning." 12 months? Seriously? We're going to go make beauty. Now, what does this indicate that the king is interested in? Beauty. That's it. That's what he's after. All he's concerned about is whether he gets a beauty or not. And so Esther gets to come before him. Verse 17 says, the king loved Esther more than all of the other women. She obtained grace and favor in his sight. And so he made Esther queen. Look in verse 18. How would you like this? Not only made her queen, but he made a feast in her honor. What did he call the feast? Duh. You're going to make a feast in her honor? It's a feast of Esther. Now, I don't know if the feast of Vashti rolled around every year, but that'd be kind of off-putting, wouldn't it? You know, if you were the queen and all of a sudden the queen of feast of Vashti, you know, came up, are you supposed to go and celebrate that or not? I don't think so. Esther becomes queen. What kind of woman was Esther? What kind of woman? If we were to characterize Esther.
Quiet.
Quiet? Why do you say quiet?
Because
she kept her mouth shut, right?
She didn't ask for anything.
She didn't ask for anything. Look at that. All of the women, look at verse 13. Thus prepared, each young, this is chapter 2, sorry. Chapter 2, verse 13. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king. And she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women to the custody of, you say that name, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. All right, so they're more than just a face. He's got to remember the name. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing. What could she have taken with her? Anything she wanted. She requested nothing. But what Hegai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, whatever he advised her to take, she would take. But besides that, she wasn't interested in taking anything else. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Go back to verse 9. Remember Hegai, the custodian of the women? How would you like that job? Now the young woman, Esther, verse 9, pleased him, Hegai. And she obtained favor in his sight, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her. I don't know if that means she needed them more than the others, but he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Yet Esther had not yet revealed her people or her family. Why not? Because Mordecai said, don't do it. And so Esther, what kind of woman is Esther? Esther is a woman who is obedient. Go down to verse 20. Esther, it says the same thing that we saw up in verse 10, verse 20. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. She's still a respectful. She's still obedient to the man who had raised her. And what is her reaction in chapter 4, verse 4, when she hears about the plot? Does she have a mindset that says, well, you know, fortunately, I'm here in the palace and I'm going to be okay? Chapter 4, verse 4 says that she was deeply distressed. So what did Mordecai ask of Esther? Jews are going to be killed. Esther's the queen. What did Mordecai ask of Esther? You got to go to the king. Esther, you've got to go to the king and you've got to say something. He commanded her. Look in chapter 4 and verse 8. It was not just, please, would you do this? He commanded her to go to the king in order that she might make that request to the king. How would you feel if you were Esther? How would you feel if you're Esther and your father? He's your cousin, but he's also, in a sense, your father figure. He says, go in and tell him what's going on. Here's Esther. She's been queen. She's been queen for 5 years. We'll have that on the screen in just a minute. But look in chapter 3 and verse 7. We saw chapter 3 and verse 7 where it says that it was the 12th year of King Ahasuerus' reign. That's the 12th year. Go back to chapter 2. I don't think we saw this verse. In verse 16, Esther became queen in his 7th year. And so 5 years have passed from the time that she was made queen to the time that this plot becomes known and is becoming very real in the palace there with the king and the queen. Look in chapter 4, verse 13. Look at what Mordecai tells Esther. Do not think in your heart that you're going to escape. Is it possible that she thought she could? I mean, she's a Jew, and Haman wanted to wipe out all of the Jews, but, you know, nobody knew she was a Jew. She hadn't said anything. Mordecai says, you don't need to think that you're safe. Perhaps she did. And here's the key verse in the book of Esther, chapter 4, verse 14. For if you remain completely silent at this time, well, then deliverance is going to come from somewhere else. God's not going to let his people be wiped out. So Esther, if you don't say anything, then God's going to take care of this from somewhere else. But you and your father's house are going to perish. Yet, who knows? Who knows but whether you have been brought to the kingdom? Who knows whether you are in the palace as the queen for such a time as this? You probably know from previous studies of the book of Esther, how many times is God mentioned in the book of Esther? How many times is God's name in the book of Esther? God is not named. The word God, the word Lord, the word Jehovah, there is no name used for God in the book of Esther. You've got 10 chapters of a Bible book that does not say anything about God. Except it does say something about God, doesn't it? While you may not see the word God on the page, he is on every page. The story of the providence of God in this account, I wish we had time to look at it, but that's not the focus of tonight's lesson. But how did she become queen? Of all the people, how did she become queen? Of all the people to become queen, how was it her, and how was it that Mordecai was in a position to be able to come and to convey a message to her? And how was it that she was able to carry on through messenger this conversation with Mordecai? How was it that she was permitted to speak to the king? How was it that he did not put her to... How was it... And you keep asking, how was it? How was it? How was it? How was it all through this book? And there's only one answer. God made this happen. So here's Esther. Here's Esther who has been asked, you need to say something to the king to save your people. She's been queen for 5 years. Look in chapter 4 and verse 11. This was her first response. Chapter 4, verse 11. Her first response back to Mordecai. Mordecai, everybody knows this. Everybody knows that no one is permitted to come before the king. Mordecai, what you are asking of me is a death sentence. You want me to go before the king? No one, not even the queen, no one is permitted to come before the king unless they have an appointment, unless they have been called. And there is only one law about those who come before him without permission. What's the law? You're dead. But there's one exception. And that is if the king holds his golden censer out towards that person, then they may come before the king. So for Esther to go before the king, what is she relying on? What is she hoping for? She only has one hope. The only hope she has is for that golden scepter to be raised to her. Otherwise, she's dead before the rest of the Jews are. And so she sends that message back to Haman, or back to Mordecai. Mordecai sends another message back to her, and she just evaluates the situation. She evaluates and says, okay, I'm in trouble, but not just me. My brethren are in trouble. The king's right-hand man, he's got the king in his pocket. What are we going to do about that? The king is going right along with Haman's plot and doesn't even realize what's going on, but who's going to change that? You got the two most powerful people in the kingdom who are going down this road. Who's going to move them? And Esther realized, nobody has a shot at this except for me. Nobody. Now, could she have stayed quiet? Could she have gone along her merry way? Could she have denied any claims that came up later on that she was a Jew and that she should have died right along with them? Here's a woman who put others far above herself, who removed herself out of the equation, although she's included, removes herself out of the equation long enough to say, here is what I believe. In her heart, she believes exactly what Mordecai said. God must have put me here. And if God put me here, shame on me if I say no to God. So you've got self-centeredness and you've got selflessness. Here's what I want us to do. I want us to go through the rest of this account. I want us to go through the rest, and I know that we know this story. But I want us to go through it and look at this contrast. Look at the contrast that just keeps coming up between Haman and Esther. Between self-centeredness and her selflessness. Look at some of these, and we're going to rush through some of these at some point. But every time you see the word self-centeredness up here, it's talking about Haman. I'm not using their names, I'm using the characterization. Here's Haman, self-centeredness. Here's Esther, selflessness. You go to chapter 3. And in chapter 3 is where Haman is just fussing and pouting and just being a pain that Mordecai won't bow down to me. You know, he's got everything else in the world, but Mordecai won't bow down to him. And so his world is just crumbling. Look in chapter 4 and verse 16. When Esther finally decides, when she finally makes up her mind that, yes, I am going to do this, what does she tell Mordecai for the people to do? Fast for me for 3 days. Now again, the name of God is not anywhere in this book. But why did they fast? What was the purpose? What was the purpose of fasting? Devote yourself to prayer. Why? Why do you want to devote yourself to prayer for 3 days? Did she not realize? If I'm going to do this, I can't do it by myself. If I'm going to do this, there's no way I'm going to make it through this by myself. You go and you have the Jews fast for 3 days, but I'm not just asking them to do it for me. I am going to do it too. She says, my maids and I, we are going to go and we're going to do it too. To fast, to keep themselves from the physical desires in order to enhance their spiritual devotion to God. She recognized her total dependence on God and knew that she was not going to make it without him. Think about some of these contrasts. While self-centeredness, that's Haman, while self-centeredness was not satisfied, unless he could bring an entire race to death, Look at what Esther says in chapter 4 and verse 16. After she says, "Fast for me," what does she say? "If I perish, I perish." She was willing to put her neck on the line for her entire nation. Look at the contrast. Here's self-centered Haman. He wants to kill all of these people. Why? Because of one person. Here is selfless Esther. What does she want to do? Save all of these people. And it might kill her in the process. Big difference. Big difference between someone who is self-centered and someone who is selfish. Self-centered Haman. He created a law in order to harm other people. What does selfless Esther do? She's willing to break a law in order to save the people. And somebody says, "Well, that's not good. You're not supposed to break the law. You know, that doesn't speak well of her. You know, if she knows the law that she's not supposed to appear before the king, and she does it anyway, then she's breaking the law." Did Peter and John and the apostles break the law, as you might say it, in Acts chapters 4 and 5 when they went preaching? What were they told to do? Stop preaching. What did they do? Preached. Why? Couldn't help it. The law of God superseded the law of man. What was involved with Esther here? The law of God, her devotion to God, superseded anything else. Self-centered Haman. Self-centered Haman deceived the king to get his wish. Well, here's a people and they don't like your laws and they don't obey your laws. And he made all of this sound really bad against the Jews. But what about Esther? Look in chapter 5 and verse 1. She faced the law of death. Here's self-centered Haman. Self-centered Haman deceives the king. Selfless Esther comes before the king and she's got to be scared to death. Self-centered Haman comes before the king in chapter 3 and he is pushy. Look at him in chapter 3 verse 9 where he says, "If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed." And king, don't you say no. King, you're going to like this. I will pay for it. He's pushy. He's got to have his way. But when you get to read about Esther, look in chapter 5. When she gets before the king, in chapter 5 and verse 8, what does she say? If. Did Haman ever say if? Did Haman ever let the king think for himself? Here, this is what you need to do. Here's what we're going to do, and I'll pay for it. Okay, done deal. Just sign on the dotted line. All right, see you later. Here comes Esther. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition. What if it didn't please the king to grant her petition? She was willing to take that chance. But she comes before the king in a selfless manner, in a timid and patient way, whereas self-centered Haman, he was pushy, he was hasty. Self-centered Haman bragged about how great he was. Do self-centered people do that? Self-centered people brag about what they have accomplished, brag about how many great things that they have. Look in chapter 5 where you see that Esther... Look in verse 3, chapter 5, verse 3. The king said to Esther, "Esther, what's your wish? What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you up to half the kingdom." What could she have answered? She could have answered anything that she wanted. She's very careful in how she answers. What does she answer the first time? She answers first and says, "Bring Haman." The king said, "Bring Haman quickly," because her request in verse 4, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. So they come to the banquet in verse 6. And at the banquet, the king said to Esther the same thing. What is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. And that's where Esther said, King, here's my request. You see a woman who's extremely cautious in how she goes about, she had at that moment, she had great power. When the king says, I'm going to give you half my kingdom, she has him right there in her hand. She could have missed. Imagine if the king had said that to Haman. Here's Esther. She's got everything right there in her hand, and she's very cautious in how she uses it. Here's self-centered Haman. He only thought about what would make him feel better. Look in chapter 6. He's all about himself. He only wants to make sure that he is taken care of. In chapter 6 and verse 4, the king said, who is in the court? Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace. He came there to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. Why did he come there? Because he wanted to make himself feel better. When he comes before the king, all he wants is his own personal comfort taken care of. You go back and the next three are going to talk about Mordecai. On this selfless note down here, this is talking about Mordecai. When Mordecai sent a message to the king, was he all concerned about his own personal comfort? We didn't talk about the original plot that Mordecai found out about. But the end of chapter 2, Mordecai found out that there were two of the men at the gate who were plotting to kill the king. Mordecai sent a message to the king in order that he might learn of this plot, in order that he might be saved. Mordecai, when he thinks about life, he's looking out for others' well-being. Here's self-centered Haman. All he's concerned about is his own personal comfort. Self-centered Haman could only think of himself and his own honor. Look in chapter 6. This part of the story cracks me up. We saw in chapter 5, the end of chapter 5, where his family told him, just go make the gallows and hang the guy and stop your whining. You know, just get this over with. So we saw in, look in chapter 6, verse 3. The king said, what honor or dignity, he just heard. By the way, the king couldn't sleep one night. That's what happened in verse 1. He brought somebody in to read the history of Persia. He heard about what Mordecai had done. He asked in verse 3, what honor was given to Mordecai for what he did in saving my life? And the servant answered and said, nothing's been done. So that's where the king said, well, all right, we've got to fix this. So the king's servant said to him, Haman's there, verse 5. So they brought Haman in. Now listen through the ears of Haman. Listen to the question in verse 6. Haman came in and the king asked, Haman, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Oh, you're talking about me. Of course you're talking about, you want to honor me. Now Haman thought in his heart, of course he did, what should be done to honor the person the king wants to honor? Okay, here's what you need to do. Whom would the king delight to honor more than me, is what he says in his heart. So Haman answered the king in verse 7, for this man, yeah, I know you're talking about me, whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes. And when he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. I know you're talking about me. Then parade him on horseback throughout the entire city square and have the servant proclaim this out in front of the horse. Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. While Haman is riding on the horse with all of the garb that had been given, he's picturing all of this in his head. When the king wants to know, how are we going to honor somebody? All Haman can think of is, you got to be talking about me. You can't be thinking about anybody else to honor except for me. But what about selfless Haman? He's more concerned about letting other people take care of the honor. You see that Mordecai is the one who is honored, but is he all about receiving the honor? Is he all wrapped up in making sure that people know that it's him that's riding on that horse? He's not the one that's concerned about receiving that honor. Quickly, let's go through some of these. Self-centered Haman, he pouted. He pouted when he wasn't the one who got to ride on the horse. You look in chapter 6, what a baby. You look in chapter 6, and verse 10 is where the king said to Haman, "Okay, hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested." "Yes, Lord." "The horse, yes, I've got that." "Yes, the robe, okay, I'll put it on." And what does he say? "Do so for who? Mordecai the Jew who sits within the king's gate? Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." No, Lord, that's me. That's not for Mordecai. So Haman took the robe and the horse. Haman arrayed Mordecai. Haman led him on horseback through the city. And Haman, he is dying. Haman proclaimed, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights." Can you hear the excitement in his voice as he saying, "Thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights"? Afterward, Mordecai goes back to where he came from. Does Mordecai think he's something? Mordecai goes back to where he's been for the last several years. What does Haman do? Haman hurried to his house. What's he doing? Mourning. Can you believe what they did to me? He's got his head covered. Why does he cover his head? "I don't want anybody to know it was me. I don't want anybody to know I was leading that horse and I was pretty." No. He is ashamed. He is embarrassed. He is angry. And he's mourning because he's a big fat baby and it wasn't him on that horse. Self-centered Haman gets this message from his family. They're the ones who told him, "All right, go build the gallows and hang the guy." Now he gets back and tells them what's going on. And what do they say to him in verse 13? "Haman, you're dead." I mean, that's basically what they say. "Haman, you're a goner. If that's what happened, if Mordecai the Jew is the one who was honored, you're a dead man." So he hears that his life is about over and his doom has been stated. But what does what's Esther doing? She's nervously hosting another feast. Let's jump through some of these. Self-centeredness. Haman, he would have loved a blank check. But that's exactly, the blank check is exactly what the king gave to Esther. Did he trust her? Must have. You don't give a blank check to the queen unless you trust her. Self-centered Haman demanded that his desires be met. But when selfless Esther came before the king, it was always, "If you desire, if this pleases the Lord." Self-centered Haman sat in a place of honor at the dinner table with the king. All the while, selfless Esther was trying to carefully word her petition. Self-centered Haman was terrified and he begged for his life at that second banquet, actually the third banquet, when he finally said, it's the second banquet, it's the third request, when the king finally said, "What do you want?" And she said, "Me and my people, there's a plot to kill us." And the king said, "Who has made this plot?" And Haman's sitting right there. And she says it was Haman. Chapter 7 verse 8 says he was terrified. I think it's verse 6 says he was terrified. The king got up and he stepped outside. He knew bad stuff was going down. His wife had just implicated his best man, his right-hand man. And now he knows this guy's got to die. He steps outside. Haman falls on the couch where Esther is sitting and pleads with her for his life. The irony is incredible. She is Mordecai's cousin. He hates Mordecai, wants to put Mordecai to death. He is groveling at the feet of a woman who is Mordecai's cousin who holds his life in her fingers. Self-centered Haman doesn't know what to do. selfless, Esther did not dare tell the king what to do. Notice that when he asked her, she does not say, do this. Self-centered Haman brings shame and ruin on himself. Self-centered or selfless Esther receives grace and gifts from the king. Self-centered Haman, he turned people off. The self-centeredness turned people off? Yeah. Selflessness in the life of Mordecai and Esther, it appealed to people. Look in chapter 8. We're about out of time. Look in chapter 8, verse 17. This is after Haman has been hanged on his own gallows that he was kind enough to make for his own death. Chapter 8, verse 17, in every province and city where the king's command, this is the second decree that comes out. It's written by Esther and Mordecai. It has put the king's seal on it by them. They send out a message that says Jews can defend themselves when the Persians try to kill them. In every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews. What? Many of the people of the land became Jews because a fear of the Jews fell upon them. Well, if they're going to be the protected people, I want to be a Jew. I'll be a Jew. Okay, I'm one of them now, so don't hurt me. Don't do anything to me, because that's an interesting conversion method, isn't it? To allow that to happen. Self-centeredness starts with joy. It's all about me. You know where it ends? In sorrow. Selflessness starts in a place of humility and allows self to be exalted by someone else. Self-centeredness only thinks of self. Selflessness thinks of others. Self-centeredness works only to advance self. Selflessness is willing to sacrifice for others. Self-centeredness says, what is God going to do for me? Selflessness says, what can I do for God? And both of these, Haman and Esther, self-centeredness and selflessness prove this Bible truth. Whatever a man sows, he's going to reap it. Did Haman sow? Did Haman reap what he sowed? Did he get what was coming? Do you smile when you read that part of it that says he was taken to his own gallows and he was hanged? Do you think, you deserve that, buddy? You had that coming. When you read about Esther, did she reap what she sowed? Was it ever all about Esther? Was it ever what she could offer? It was never about her. She was simply a tool that was put into a position to be used by God. And she opened herself up to God and said, God, use me. Are we tools that God has put in a particular position, in a particular place? Have we opened ourselves up selflessly to God and said, God, just use me. Whatever you want, let your will be done. There's a lot in this story, and I'm sorry we had to rush through some of that.